Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am R. Henry Moore. I represent Cumberland Coal Resources in this matter. This matter involves four citations that were issued to Cumberland involving a mandatory standard promulgated by Mine Safety and Health Administration with respect to lifelines and escapeways. Lifelines are something of a recent requirement. They were required first in March of 2006 by MSHA, an emergency temporary standard, and then required by Congress. Though Cumberland had them in place in its return escapeways for a number of years. Lifelines are one tool to help miners get out of the mine when there's an emergency, but there's a whole array of tools that come into play. For example, there are self-contained self-rescuers each miner has. There are devices in the conveyor belt where if you're going to have a fire, that's where it's going to be to detect carbon monoxide even before you get a fire. There are ventilation, the escapeways are required.
You may want to move closer to the issue in the case, counsel.
Yes, I was trying to give the overview, Your Honor, but I will. This case involves the test for S&S under Section 104D of the Act. That test has been in place since the early 1980s in the Matthews Coal case, and it's a four-prong test. And historically, of those four prongs, one, there obviously has to be a violation. Two, there has to be a discrete safety hazard. There has to be a reasonable likelihood that the hazard it contributed to will result in an injury, and a reasonable likelihood that the injury will be reasonably serious. Historically, the disputes in the cases have been whether or not an event likely to cause an injury was reasonably likely. The Commission has changed that. In this particular case, what they did is, in terms of evaluating hazard, they said the hazard is what I consider to be a generic hazard, is the inability to escape in a smoke-filled environment. And then what they did is they took reasonably likely to result in an injury and said, we're only going to look at this hazard, this lifeline, and we're going to look at it in isolation. Now, the Secretary obviously argues you'd assume an emergency.
Don't you have to do that? It seemed to me that under your analysis, if they'd left the lifeline out altogether, it couldn't be a pass your S&S test. Couldn't pass your test.
I don't think...
How would it become any more serious to leave it out altogether than it does to have it in a faulty fashion like it is here?
Well, it wouldn't be there at all.
Right.
And
but if
this
you make
case,
your assumption that you have to plan your odds based on the odds of whether you have the fire in the first place, then the... I don't see how the passing your test is any different with it gone altogether than it would be if it was faulty.
By the Commission's test and the Secretary's extension of the Commission's test, you are evaluating something in total isolation.
Why don't you answer Judge Sentell's question, which is that would there be, under your theory, there would not be a substantial and significant, right, if they hadn't made a finding that a fire or an explosion was likely, but there was no lifeline at all? That was his question.
I hadn't thought about
that. And that's the logic,
that.
But that's the logic of your position.
I
don't understand how you didn't think of it. The government makes that point in its brief.
Well,
the government makes that very point.
If you take the no lifeline situation, and you've shown that there is no reasonable likelihood of a fire or an explosion using that lifeline.
Right.
That...
No, the lifeline's not there. That's the hypothetical.
The lifeline's not there. It's not there for any use at all.
Right.
You could argue that it's not S&S either. My assumption is that the argument would be as you're looking at that, and that's a difference between what we have here, which is a lifeline in place that could be used, and no lifeline. And I think there is a difference.
Why would it make any difference under your analysis? you're analyzing it that you have to look at, that you can't look at that in an isolation, and that you cannot assume there is an emergency. Those would be exactly the same if there were no lifeline at all there.
Thinking about it, Your Honor, you are correct.
Okay.
But what I am saying is you look at, but you look at other factors too.
Yeah.
Are there factors that make it more likely that there would be a fire or explosion? Because in this case, everybody admits there's no likelihood of a fire or an explosion. So
no violation ever becomes S&S under your view?
Not no violation. This case is listed limited to the lifelines, Your Honor, as the commission very specifically did. I think, frankly, we cited some cases where you could make the argument it was S&S. The problem is as the commission's currently constructed it, you can't evaluate this condition in terms of the actual facts. You take a hazard that's a sort of generic hazard, and then you say, well, that generic hazard in and of itself caused it. So you're never evaluating what facts
are. What do you think of the intervener's point that it's very, very hard to predict the occurrence of a fire or an explosion, and they might occur even when there aren't any obvious conditions around, because situations in mines change rapidly, and fires and explosions can be caused by things that don't appear obvious during the inspection. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction is I think that's an overstatement, Your Honor.
I see.
While, yes, at the face where mining is occurring, there is change going on. But out back, I use the term out by because that's a common term in the industry, back away from the faces, out toward the works that have been established, they don't change rapidly. Yes, you could have a fire or explosion. You can't necessarily predict that.
Right.
But you have to do what S&S is, as I see it, is a risk assessment. And if it's a risk assessment, then you look at the risks, and you take into account all the circumstances.
There's so many situations in society. I mean, you're right, it's a risk assessment, but there are so many precautions we take, not because we think the emergency is likely to happen, but because of the catastrophic results of one if it does. I mean, take, for example, airplanes, right? The papers report this week there hasn't been an airplane crash in this country in 4 years. So under your theory, that would mean that airlines that don't continue the kinds of safety precautions that we require on commercial airliners, like escape lighting and slides and all those and oxygen, that the failure to have those wouldn't be a serious problem because the likelihood of an accident in which they're needed is so remote. This seems to be exactly the same thing, that these are required not because we think an explosion is likely, but because if one does happen, the results could be catastrophic, and this is what we need. That's what the commission said in its decision, didn't it? So what's the matter with that reasoning?
Well, I would back up a step from your analogy, Your Honor.
Uh-huh.
Flying in an airplane is safe. And while we have all of these protections, should there be a failure, it is fundamentally safe. And in this case, what the commission has done and what MSHA wants to do is to treat
I think
those
you're about to make the secretary's case for him.
No, I'm
her, excuse me. I think you're about to make her. You may want to pause because
you're about to approve
her case,
no,
that she's right here.
The commission has said in this case that only minor violations would be non-S&S. They have historically said that rejected the opinion that technical violations, all but technical violations, should be S&S. S&S is an important part of the Mine Act. It is not the be-all and end-all. If you take S&S out of here, the penalties are assessed regardless of the S&S finding. Historically, and this court is probably aware of it, non-S&S citations were assessed a single penalty. That's no longer the case as of 2007. So the penalties, which are supposed to have a deterrent effect, go into, it doesn't matter whether they are, whether it's S&S or not. S&S has two key components. One is on pattern of violations, which MSHA just published a rule a week or two ago on their final rule on pattern of violations. And they have been using it, though historically they hadn't, but they have been using it the last several years. And it also goes into effect in terms of the unwarrantable failure chain. Now, it's not for every unwarrantable failure order. It's only for the first D1 citation has to be S&S. Everything else can be non-S&S. So while, but it's an important tool. But in this situation, the way the commission's interpreted this, it really doesn't mean anything. It has been devalued. It's been turned into everything but minor violations, everything but technical violations. And we don't think that is consistent with their own case law. Nor, frankly, do I think it's consistent with this circuit's case law.
How is it inconsistent with the circuit case law?
Well, it's interesting, Your Honor. The Jim Walters case, I call it the Jim Walters case. It's Secretary of Labor versus Mine Safety and Health Review Commission, 111 Fed 2nd, Fed 3rd, excuse me, showing my age, 913, where you were dealing with the issue of whether non-violative nearby conditions could be taken into account on S&S. And you said no. And you said no in terms of the third leg of the Matthews test. But you did say if you're looking at the hazard, that's where you look at other things. And what all we're saying here is if you're going to interpret...
What language in that 111 F3rd case is it that you're saying?
On page, well, let's see, I'm trying to find the language that I'm referring to. When evaluating the first question, existence of a hazard, the commission does consider surrounding conditions. And I'm looking for the page number, and so it's 913, so it would be 917 of the reported decision. And it refers this, the case, the court then cited Cypress Plateau Mining Company and Secretary of Labor versus Texas Gulf. Texas Gulf is a very interesting case.
What is the language in that 111 case that you say the Secretary is acting inconsistently with now and how?
Well, because it's not both the Commission and the Secretary are not evaluating the first question, existence of a hazard, in terms of the surrounding conditions. The surrounding conditions here are not only the likelihood of the fire, but what all the protections in place in case you have a fire and to prevent contamination of an escapeway. Those are all, I think, contained within that language. I think that what the commission has done here is substantially weaken the S&S finding. And in so doing, they say, well, it'll be difficult to prove an S&S. The Secretary of Labor may be held to her actual burden of proof. But I will tell you, you need only look no further than this case to see how she met that burden of proof. She put on an inspector who has about 15, 16 years as inspector. He didn't testify to any experience escaping in smoke, any experience investigating fires, any experience fighting fires, any mine rescue experience. And his testimony was accepted over that of Mr. Bohatch, who has a mining engineering degree, a master's in mine safety, has been in mine fires, has fought mine fires, has been on mine rescue.
Do you know of any case where we have second-guessed a decision of that kind, that kind of safety decision, where we've gone into that kind of detail about the competing evidence? Can you cite any case where we've ever...
Off the top of my head, I cannot.
Yeah, I can't think of one either.
But I will say that the Jim Walters case is a very interesting case that way because here's the secretary saying you ought to consider this pile of material that was not in active workings. And this court said, no, we're not going to do that.
You want to save a minute for rebuttal?
Yes, I do.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Robin Rosenbluth, and I represent the Secretary of Labor in this case. The language of Section 104D1 of the Mine Act, which describes what a significant and substantial violation is, the history and purpose of the Mine Act, the history and purpose of the Lifeline Standard, all compel the conclusion that in evaluating whether Cumberland's four violations of the Lifeline Standard were significant and substantial, the decision maker must assume the emergency contemplated by the standard, that is, an emergency where miners would be required to use the escapeway in question.
So your argument is that this violates the plain language of the statute. You're not relying on the second level of...
We are relying on both levels.
From your brief. Your brief, you set out the two Chevron standards, but I couldn't tell from your brief whether you really think this is plain language. I mean, you talk about it, your position being consistent with the language, and at one point you do say 35 to 36. You do seem to say that the language of the statute precludes the Cumberland's challenge. I mean, is that what your position is, that this language is clear?
Our position is that the language is clear, but alternatively, if the court finds there's an ambiguity, our position is that our interpretation...
And what in the language makes this clear? I'm looking at it. It says, could significantly and substantially contribute...
To the cause and effect of a hazard.
Effect. So...
In determining whether the degree to which something contributes to a hazard that only arises in a particular situation, a decision maker has to assume that particular situation to determine the degree of the contribution. For example, if one is seeking to determine the degree to which not wearing a safety belt causes injury and the severity of those injuries in a car accident, one has to assume the car accident. In the same way, if one is attempting to determine the degree to which not having a lifeline in place contributes to injury and the severity of injury in an emergency where lifelines are necessary to escape, one must assume that emergency. I think Cumberland's position is also fundamentally inconsistent with Congress's use of the word could in Section 104D1. A determination concerning the degree to which something could contribute to a hazard, which is what Section 104D1 requires a decision maker to decide, does not involve a determination of the likelihood of that hazard. Instead, it requires one to look at the intrinsic capacity of the hazard to of the thing to contribute to the hazard.
I mean, petitioner argues that the commission has said that could is not enough for an SNS violation.
2 points. First of all, the commission has said that could is not enough. That is the commission's Matthews test, and to the extent that it is inconsistent with the language of Section 104D1, we don't agree with that test. In any event, in this case, there were certainly a lot more evidence that miners could be seriously injured by not being able to escape quickly. And on that point, I would note that should the court find that the commission's Matthews test is fundamentally inconsistent with assuming the emergency, the court must defer to the secretary's interpretation if the court also finds ambiguity, because the secretary's interpretation, not the commission's interpretation, is entitled to deference under this court's decision in Excel and National Cement and a number of other cases.
Could I just clarify one other thing? The appellant argues it really doesn't matter whether it's S&S because there are other progressive disciplinary provisions in the statute. The intervener argues that the 104 progressive discipline is different. Is that correct?
That is correct. Section 104 D1 and Section 104E are extremely important tools under the Mine Act because they are designating a violation to be S&S is important because it provides the potential basis for Section 104 D1 and Section 104E withdrawal orders. And Congress, in enacting the Mine Act, understood that simply an increase in penalty size was not enough to effectively deter operators from violations, and as such, it provided the Secretary with authorization to issue withdrawal orders under Section 104 D1 and 104.
So does that cut in favor of the Secretary's broad interpretation or not?
It cuts in favor because it cannot be those are very important enforcement tools, and it cannot be.
Right, but if the sanction is so severe,
the sanction is severe, but not having lifeline violations or other evacuation requirements has the potential to produce catastrophic results. And Congress took the extraordinary measure of amending the Mine Act after two.
I'm just trying to understand what's really at stake here. Because the petitioner has lifelines, they're just not in the right place, or they're not hung properly. What?
They're not hung upright either.
Yes, right.
Reverse J-hooks could cause some real tangles. You know?
Yes.
Well, if they were, miners would have to use a tool. Remember, they would be completely blinded and have to hopefully try to flip them out, and there's testimony that would take considerable delay. But certainly, you know, those enforcement sanctions, to get on the 104 D1 chain, first of all, you don't just get a significant and substantial violation. That doesn't put you on the chain. You also have to have an unwarrantable failure violation, which means aggravated conduct constituting more than ordinary negligence. So you can't just get on the chain easily. And in Section 104E cases, while Cumberland is acting like you get a potential pattern or a pattern of violation status easily, in the history of the Mine Act, this only two operators have had such egregious and dangerous mine histories that they have been put on they've been put on a pattern of violations. So these are not tools that simply an S&S violation designation will get you a withdrawal order for. And again, under Cumberland's approach, to take Judge Sintel's example one step further, an operator could have absolutely no escapeways in place whatsoever and repeatedly have no escapeways in place whatsoever, and the Secretary would not be able to use her enforcement tools and cite those violations as significant and substantial. And again, I go back to the fact that in response to catastrophic mine accidents in 2006 where 11 miners in the Sago explosion, they survived the initial explosion, but they couldn't find their way out of the mine in extremely smoky conditions, and they ultimately perished due to carbon monoxide poisoning. In response to the Alma Aracoma mine disaster shortly thereafter, where two miners who survived a belt fire couldn't find their way out of a mine in smoky conditions, and as the inspector testified in this case, tried to use a cable to find their way out of the mine, but there were no directional cones on the cable, and they ultimately succumbed to carbon monoxide poisoning. So the Secretary will never be able to prove that the emergency contemplated by the standard. It has happened before. And again, it cannot be that Congress took the extraordinary step of amending the Mine Act if it did not intend the Secretary to be able to use her enforcement sanctions. And I would just note in response to, I think, Judge Tatel's question, and ask the intervener pointed out in this case, in the Sago mine disaster, where 11 miners lost their life, the Secretary, after investigating that accident, was not able to find a contributory violation and determined that the disaster was caused by sort of the fluky condition of a lightning strike hitting above ground and somehow traveling into the mine and igniting methane in the back of the mine. So as Judge Tatel pointed out, mining is a dynamic environment, and the Secretary's inspectors cannot always find every situation that could lead to the catastrophic events that happened in Sago and Alma, and also in the Darby mine, which also happened, where there was also a catastrophic mine accident.
Can you give us an example of the lifeline violation that wouldn't be significant and substantial?
I can, Your Honor. For example, in the standard, in this case, 75.380D7, for example, there's a requirement that reflectors be placed every 25 feet along the lifeline. Arguably, if the mine operator had placed the reflectors every 26 feet or one reflector was out of place, assuming the contemplated emergency, that might be determined to be non-significant and substantial. Mm-hmm. However, the fact that many lifeline violations where to prove the violation, the Secretary had to prove that miners, the placement of the lifelines would be such that miners would be delayed in escaping a mine, I think, given the catastrophic potential for miners to the results that would happen if they can't escape a mine, it is not wrong that many lifeline violations would be found to be SNS. Just as it's not wrong for every time an operator doesn't have any escape way in place, that situation be determined to be significant and substantial, because certainly under the plain language of 104D1, those situations significantly and substantially contribute to the cause and effect of a hazard.
All right. Anything further?
No, absent further questions.
Thank you. Counsel for petition.
The assuming the emergency is a slippery slope.
What do you think about her argument that this is totally clear under the statute, that the statute makes it clear?
I'm trying to think of how to answer that, because what happens is the Secretary keeps saying could contribute, and that's enough. Well, it's not could contribute, it's could significantly and substantially contribute. And so I don't think, frankly, it is as clear as they would like. And I think back in when they decided Matthews, National Gypsum, U.S. Steel, and that line of cases, they came up with a test based on the language that has been the test since the early 1980s. And for that reason, I think that it's not as clear as the Secretary would have it, but I think it's established. But I will also say when they stand here and say assume the emergency, at pages 32 and 33 of our initial brief, we outline what the inspector actually assumed. He didn't assume. What we're talking about in each one of these is a lifeline in one of the two escapeways. But the inspector, to come to his conclusion, assumed not only the escapeway with the efficient lifeline in it was full of smoke, but the adjacent escapeway was full of smoke, and that you couldn't, and there were a whole number of other protections that were in place that wouldn't come into play. So, because, for example, in the belt entry, that air is going in and out of the mine. The adjacent intake escapeway, the air is coming into the mine. So and that's why it's the primary escapeway, and it's pressurized. If you have something in the belt entry, it's not going to leak into the... So our argument that all of the additional protections should be taken into account, I think, is put in a different light if you look at it, if you're assuming an emergency. What emergency are you assuming? Because are you assuming smoke-filled just in the belt entry? Are you assuming everything's contaminated? I think that's the problem. I would also simply note that reference to Sago and Aracoma is a slippery slope also. Sago, what happened is they had an explosion in a sealed area caused by lightning, and in the mine itself, it didn't explode where the active miners were, but you had the effects of the explosion, and you had carbon monoxide. And the miners in what is known as the two left section came out of the mine, started out of the mine on a track entry. It was blocked by debris. They tried to come out the escapeway. We don't know why they turned around and went back up and barricaded themselves. We had one survivor, and frankly, you can't really... I understand his what he went through, but I'm leery of relying on him. In Aracoma, they were coming out of the mine, and the crew got out, with the exception of two guys, who, for whatever reason, quit holding on to the people in front of them when they came out. We don't know why that happened. So, and we frankly don't...
could is not as clear as the Secretary says.
No,
but
it's not
is
as clear.
It sufficiently clear to indicate what Congress intended?
Well, and I realize that I have a problem because obviously if it's not clear...
Then it's Chevron 2.
Then it's Chevron 2. But the problem we have here is that we've got the additional problem is we have well-established case law that we've been applying for 30 years. And now all of a sudden, the Secretary wants to change it. And their attempts to change it have been rejected over the years. And the other problem with the Secretary's argument about it clear, they just say could contribute. The Commission says could by itself isn't enough, but they forget significant and substantial. How do you interpret that? And they're not telling you how they would interpret that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case under advisement.